And morning, 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 dear listeners, wherever you find yourself. Well, let's just hope you are as warm as I am pretending to be. But primarily, you know, in terms of, there's always a trade-off, specifically with the early morning sessions, in that, you know, it's you, weather, you know, and specifically how you adjust or how you basically prepare for a weather scenario. But nonetheless, here on the early morning sessions of my Sunday morning take, what we always do specifically, we get in touch with each other specifically around topics around, well, significant historical topics, significant scientific, and obviously, well, they all have history in them, and some geography as well thrown there into the mix. This morning session is no other. Well, it's no different than what we've done so far. But this time we take a look into the realm specifically of the financial sector from a historical base and from a historical designation. Because what has been peculiar to me is that people have never actually interrogated the idea of central banks. And not the idea in terms of their existence. We know why they exist. They are, firstly, they obviously have to, there has to be an entity that has to drive monetary policy in an economy. That's now of a sovereign state, of a sovereign country. And the second scenario is that, you know, obviously this, another government functionary can't be generating the fiscal policy and also doing the monetary at the same time, even though our central bank in our case is technically also owned by the government. But it has literally two, but it's a left arm, right arm relationship. But we're not here to talk about Bank of Namibia. We're here to talk about where did the idea of central banks come from? How did they happen? And I'll actually also throw a little bit of, you know, a little bit of a curveball, little piece of information into this particular discussion, is that there is a book. I don't own the book. I was just curious in terms of when I heard of, there's this one particular list that one guy made on YouTube about the most suppressed books that you, that have ever taken place, that have ever been, you know, that the most suppressed books in human history specifically is a scenario specifically of various kinds of literature. And one of these books is the book known as The History of Central Banking, not The History of Central Banks. If you go and look up the name, The History of Central Banking, you will get why. Now, much of the literature, okay, much of the other literature sources, when I typed in that name, you know, because I was primarily trying to cast a search net as wide as possible to get me as much literature as possible, so that, you know, in order to see the various particular indications of said literature across, you know, what exists in a digital realm. The first particular indication was, what do you see when you look at central banking, and how does the aspect of central banking come about? And yes, you will get your Wikipedias, your Britannica encyclopedia in between, you know, in between there. And then comes up the other particular search results that say the history of central banking as a name, as a title. And then you get to understand, okay, why is it banned? Why is it suppressed in certain scenarios? And then you realize it's because of, when you look up the specific book, it's authored by a man by the name of Stephen Goodson. And Goodson drives a narrative specifically in his own book. This particular book tries to explain specifically that there's a handful of very powerful families in the world specifically who have got control over central banks, which is also another particular thing in terms of that understanding to an extent, potentially what that book tries to say. I've never read the book. I've only read interpretations from other people on the same, in that particular search result, what people were saying. And yeah, so if you ever stumble across the physical book itself or a e-publication of the same book, just note, guys, it's you have to read it as these are Stephen Goodson's words. The only thing is, because you have to try and then find if someone else literally correlates what he says as well. Just so that you know, that's the particular indication if you come across this book ever in your life. So, where we left off just before I quickly threw in that little bit of trivia right there is, we are looking into the history of central banking. Where does this idea come from? What were the particular impacts? And there is, lo and behold, there's always a little bit of a connection to colonialism. There always is. I was slightly surprised, but then I saw the name, one of the international banking companies in the world's name, and I was like, okay, so technically they were established as a sense of financing and extracting financing from a specific zone in the world. But we'll quickly take a short musical break, dear listeners, and we'll come back right after this, wherein we'll get into the rest of this morning's discussion here on my Sunday Morning Take. You are listening to your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM.
Lipura nenge no wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondu tuto ingida, ashike kapeno nweku dite opoye ekukurile. Oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo, iho etike kovano ile koshuala. Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM, otuna evi tota njuka, okukwetira oipindi konu kwanda doi inawa. Nuneudo, otukwetira o special ange, tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka, opone ushendi fenawa, nokumona oijamo ili nawa, ninge pata fanona, monika ko Eagle FM, onore tatu imwe bali heali, nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile konderewa, nora hetatu natu, bali o hetatu matatu, omafelane Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression with
you reach, and then I'll fight.
And as you heard the sounds there, Foreigner with Waiting for a Woman Like You, just sort of like roll out there in the background. It brings us back, or it brings you back specifically to the discussion we have here, or have begun here on my Sunday Morning Take, here this specific lovely chilly Sunday morning session. I do hope you've got something warm in your hand, as opposed to Dwight that only has, you know, a bottle of water close by. But still, this finds us obviously in the particular, you know, bookmarked area of our discussion for this morning, because just before the musical break, when I cited to you, if you've ever thought about how this particular institutions came about, specifically central banks around the world, you should probably have had an idea, you know, in terms of, okay, so which countries were the first ones, or societies around the world were the first ones to literally talk about financing for governments or financing for countries. Now, please, guys, let us also not be a little bit naive in the thinking that the societies you see today persisted, you know, forever. Technically not. Why do I say this? Well, primarily because in some cases, it's a little bit of a nuanced thing to try and understand banking back then versus banking today. But before we continue, we've got a short ad break to get to.
Join us for the Ehangano Concert Volume 2 with Ali Tobias. Experience an unforgettable evening featuring songs from her latest album, A Bilo, performed live with a full band. Special guest appearances by Tate Buti, DA, Paige, and One Accord. All proceeds from the event will go towards supporting the Our Lady Orphanage. The event takes place on 4 July 2026 at the National Theatre of Namibia. Tickets are available on Web Tickets Namibia for 450 Namibian dollars. Don't miss this powerful night of music, inspiration, and giving back. Ehangano Concert Volume 2. See you there.
We come back there from the ad, dear listeners, and just where we left off specifically is the discussion in terms of if you've ever thought about where central banks come from. It would be a interesting thing to actually go and look what had been existing in the history. Well, to be honest and to be straightforward to the point, central banks didn't exist. There was a format of banking, but it just wasn't like the thing that you know today. And another thing is also, they were technically commercial banks. They weren't central banks per se. Specifically because if you think about a bank today and you look at a bank of then, a bank of then was a massive gold vault. Yeah. Gold, copper, silver. The coins were made out of these three particular minerals. Brass was the other one. It's gold, copper, silver coins were the three particular items that were considered money. Paper money is also a new concept, because the guys that actually championed paper money is the Americans, because of the American Civil War. And that was also based on a scenario of understanding how to literally pay the soldiers on the battlefield. Well, if you don't know, an army also needs to be paid salaries. They also need to be paid some sort of money. You know, it's just a psychological thing. You constantly incentivize them specifically for putting their lives at risk. So, when we get to look into the particular aspect of central banking itself, central banking takes interesting definitions, or let me rather say it has interesting definitions that exist. I've got two particular sort of like, what you call it, literature sources open here with me. But the first one is, when you obviously try to look at the chief feature that distinguishes a central bank from a commercial bank, is that a central bank literally, they can issue the fiat currency, or the paper notes, as it is sometimes known. They also regulate this particular scenario. Now, that is the universal explanation that you will even find in Namibia, with our central bank being present, in terms of their role with money directly. The Ministry of Finance deals with budgeting, basically setting budgets or approving budgets or dispensing the necessary financing for another ministry's budget. And when this particular explanation obviously goes forward, you then look at that, when this particular aspect of a central bank, you know, which issues a fiat currency, which in most nations are the only available form of paper country. Yes, except for the very weird thing that I saw in a video of a guy that went to Iran. There was a currency he got at the airport that he could exchange his Australian dollars, euros, and American dollars for. And then when he was then advised he had to go to a recognized Iranian government money exchange agency. And he got a different aspect of the same Iranian currency at that specific scenario. So it becomes peculiar when, if you've seen the same video I've seen of this guy's, you know, him walking around in Tehran and, you know, doing sightseeing, and specifically having to explain to us, who were his viewers at the time, that he stands with two sets of currency from Iran. The one that he bought at the airport, and the one that he got, that he had to buy or exchange for in Tehran, in the capital itself. Which is a little bit strange, specifically. And then I heard also of a scenario specifically that obviously there are countries in the world where they allow not just their own currency, but another country's currency also to, you know, to be legal tender. We also allow it, obviously, with the South African rand, which is 1-to-1. But it's a scenario, obviously, of the Namibian dollar obviously cannot be used outside of Namibia, because we're literally locked in to the four corners of this country. Now, you also then have the thing of cash reserves, that commercial banks obviously then keep with the central banks as well, that they also, you know, lock away with the central banks. But it is the central banks' particular monopoly of the paper currency and the bank reserves that also allow them to exercise control over the total supply of money, which includes the overall supply of the money that commercial bank, which is also commercial bank deposits, that are available in economies over which their monopoly privileges extend. Now, to use the word monopoly technically would be based upon which country you are in. For example, if you are in the United Kingdom, the central bank of the United Kingdom is known as the Bank of England, and the Bank of England technically is, they consider themselves not to be part of the greater part of the United Kingdom. The rest of the country that uses the British pound or the pound sterling. Why? Well, I've explained to you this weird thing that is by law exists there in the UK. Apparently, just because, you know, William the Conqueror didn't conquer that specific part of London way, way back when the Normans invaded England. Supposedly, that's the only reason as to why they are technically a different part from the rest of the UK. Fine, it's their particular history. It's their particular understanding of how, you know, what decisions suffice and still impact their everyday lives. But when you come into the 21st century, and the same particular rule is literally used technically to divorce the literal ground that the Bank of England stands on that makes it literally a city within a city. There's the City of London, and then there's London City. The City of London, specifically, is the guys where the Bank of England stands on, and where all the other financial institutions of the world technically also have properties and offices in that little block of London. And then you've got London City. And London City, unfortunately, does not have any particular powers over the City of London. It's like Independence Avenue being literally a city within a city. If you want a better explanation like that. Now, this other indication also, if you now extend to other countries, for example, like in South Africa, South Africa's the Reserve Bank is not a government entity of the South African government. It's not directly owned, but it does consult and advise the Department of Finance, which is South Africa's Ministry of Finance. It does lay forward reports and assist in government policy making, but it is not directly owned. I remember just after COVID and just before COVID as well, the EFF specifically in South Africa were adamant about advancing discussions and specifically legislation in South Africa so that the South African Reserve Bank becomes an actual government institution. I was confused at the time because I assumed at the time that all central banks around the world are technically government institutions because they deal with one of the, what do they call it, the one of the national items of a country, the currency. If you guys, I will always reiterate this, if you guys don't know what are the three particular national items of a country, it's your national flag, it's your head of state, and it's your currency. The other sort of like things come after that. But in Namibia's context, it's the national flag. It's the president's flag. If you don't know what the president's flag looked like, I don't know where you've been also. And it's the national currency. They are your three main national not treasures, but more like national emblems. You know, they're like literally your national emblems. And these three national emblems are things that you don't deface. You don't cause any particular harm to it. You don't burn it. You know, if you guys have ever seen effigies, for example, internationally, where, you know, you sometimes see people in like Muslim countries burn the American flag or some other country's flag. Now, you're not supposed to do that. You're not allowed to do that in Namibia. If you don't know, there is also such a particular thing because it is, in some cases, not treasonous, but it's that other word. Basically, it's like defacing something. You're not supposed to write on money because it's also known as defacing the money. You go and read up. You'll find those rules on the Bank of Namibia. In their particular literature, you're not supposed to write on money. That's also known as defacing money, particularly because it does impact the value of that piece of paper that you've got in front of you. And all of these particular things obviously speak towards powers that emanate from the central bank. Now, central banks obviously also have other particular functions that they also participate in. By altering national money stocks, central banks also indirectly influence rates of spending and inflation, and to a far more limited extent, the rates of employment and also the production of goods and services in a country. Central banks also can influence the fate of individual banks and also the stability of the banking sector as a whole by granting or refusing emergency assistance in their role as lender of last resort. Finally, also, central banks typically also take part in the regulation of commercial banks. In this capacity, they may also enforce a variety of rules governing such things as cash reserve ratios, interest rates, investment portfolios, equity capital, and entry into the banking industry. Primarily, the last particular role that they sometimes also play is, you would have seen, it's sort of like to a lesser extent, because now the role has become one about the fintechs, the other particular developments that are taking place where certain entities are not banks, but they facilitate certain functions that are similar to what banks do. And this makes things also a little bit nuanced. Now, with all nuances aside, there's obviously one particular indication of asking the bigger question in terms of where do these central banks come from? Well, central banks play a particular role specifically as they've had a very long, should I say, a very rich history in terms of things that they're involved in that you would not know of. But before we continue, guys, we'll quickly take a short break.
Großartige Neuigkeiten. Imba ist jetzt noch besser geworden. Wir haben brandneue Funktionen hinzugefügt, um dein Erlebnis noch reibungsloser, schneller und leistungsstärker zu machen als je zuvor. Bereit, das volle Potenzial von Imba freizuschalten? Erhalte alle exklusiven Funktionen für nur 36 Namibia-Dollar pro Monat oder spare noch mehr mit unserem speziellen Abonnement-Plänen. 5% Rabatt bei einem 3-Monats-Abonnement, 10% Rabatt bei einem 6-Monats-Abonnement oder 25% Rabatt bei einem 12-Monats-Abonnement. Wähle den Plan, der am besten zu dir passt und genieße alles, was Imba zu bieten hat, zu einem unschlagbaren Preis. Imba, where the world congregates. Lade es herunter und abonniere noch heute.
Now we come back from the quick break, dear listeners, and getting into where we left off specifically, as we've all also, we've looked at certain particular things that obviously sets a central bank from a commercial bank aside. But the starting points or where they began from is one that obviously has an interesting scenario associated to it. Reason being is that when you have to look at the actual start or the actual aspect of where central banks began, was literally something that began after World War One. Sorry for the pause, but I just had to get my thought, my train of thought, or my thought processes in the right order, is that the actual start of central banks began after World War One. Now, the notion of central banks as a separate category from banking or from banks itself has emerged gradually and only fully, basically come into the fore or into adoption in the 20th century. Because after World War One, and it's literally described as that, literally between World War One and World War Two, the need for central banks become central to this discussion. This obviously means that leading central bankers of the UK and the United States, these are two gentlemen, Montagu Norman and Benjamin Strong, agreed on a definition of central banks that was both positive and normative. Now, since that time, central banks have been generally distinguishable from other financial institutions, except under communism in so-called single-tier banking systems, such as Hungary's The nation of Hungary is between 1950 and 1987, where the Hungarian National Bank operated alongside three other major state-owned banks. For earlier periods, what institutions do or do not count as central banks is also sometimes an ambiguous picture that existed. Why do I say this? Well, you can basically go as far back as Florentine time period, specifically when the Medicis were basically, you know, in their period when they were running banking in the city of Florence. This meant that the city of Florence became the banker. And when I say banker, I meant that they literally were more like a loan, a lending office or a lending scenario to other, rather, if I can say, governments, to use a more, you know, applicable term in today's particular context. So the Medicis borrowed to whoever. They borrowed, they would borrow to two sides that were fighting the same war against each other, basically, in some cases. The Medicis would obviously, you know, say, hey, listen, there is interest rates, there's this, there's that. You've got to pay after, you know, the dust is settled. You've got to settle your accounts. So, hence the reason as to why I mentioned literally that if you were trying to see the continuous picture of central banks, before World War I, things were ambiguous. They were vague, they were undefined, there was no structured situation like there is today, in terms of that a country must have a central bank, it must have these particular institutions, it must have a national currency, it must have a ministry of finance that sets budget for the central government, and you must have an ability to allow commercial banks technically to participate in your national economy. Now, a whole bunch of scholars have held different views about the timeline and the emergence of the first central banks in human history. A widely held view in one case in the second half of the 20th century has been that the Stockholm's Banco, which was established in 1657. Now, this particular example is that it came as the original issuer of bank notes. Now, remember, there was also minerals involved, because people still, back then, 1657, people used the gold standard. There were silver coins. There were brass coins. There were copper coins. So literally, minerals played a part in the particular financing at the time. Now, these banknotes by Stockholm's Banco counted as the oldest central banking system specifically, and that it consequently also its successor, the Sveriges Riksbank, was the oldest central bank in continuous operation, with the Bank of England as the second oldest and the direct and or indirect model for all subsequent central banks. Now, this particular view also persisted in some early 21st century publications. For example, in a more recent scholar particular paper, the issuance of banknotes has often been viewed as just one of several techniques to provide central bank money. If you can find the identity of the only entity that can issue money, then you know, okay, that's a central bank. Now, you'd then be asking me, okay, so but Dwight, if this is a discussion of who issued money and central banks technically only began across the world as a phenomena from the World War I, in the last century, that technically means that most particular banking institutions could issue a currency as they wanted. That is true. if you thought that way, that if you immediately went down that particular train of thought, you would be right. And we will get to that particular explanation as to what happened there. Now, in terms of understanding the particular aspect in terms of the central bank money discussion, which was sometimes also defined as financial money, which is in contrast to commodity money of the highest quality, under that particular definition, municipal banks of the late medieval and early modern periods, such as the Taula de Canvi de Barcelona, which was established in 1401, or the Bank of Amsterdam in 1609, issued central bank money and count as early central banks. Now, there's also no universal terminology for the name of a central bank, meaning there's no consensus globally. There's no thing that says, okay, if you, for example, like in the realm of politics, where the definitions of republic, the definitions of it's a republic, of a federal state, and for example, like the confusion that the British are causing specifically, that many people don't know that Canada and New Zealand and Australia are still dominions of the United Kingdom, also makes things troubling, and specifically because then you realize, okay, but you have a prime minister, but you don't have a president. You have a prime minister, you don't have your own other, you don't have your own king and stuff like that. Now, in some cases, you would sometimes see, for example, the naming convention in, let's say, politics, that everybody has, a naming convention in terms of the identity of a country. But when it comes to central banks, Bank of America is not a central bank and is not similar to Bank of England or Bank of Japan. Let me say it again. The private banking corporation by the name of Bank of America in the United States, it's a private bank. It's a commercial bank. It has the exact same name, for example, like the Bank of England, but only one between these two is a central bank and the other one is not. So Bank of America is one good example. Bank of Japan is obviously a central bank itself. And Bank of Japan allows also in some scenarios certain particular technologies to exist within its own economy. I'll mention it right now. I watched a small video excerpt. They call it now video shorts specifically in social media lingo, of this one lady that lives and works in Japan, in Tokyo specifically. And she explained, if you're a foreigner coming to Japan, just note that swipe facilities are not a thing, are not a heavy thing in Japan. And I frowned. A country that continuously has been at the forefront of technological developments, both vehicle, video game, entertainment, so on and so forth, telecommunications, you name it, computers, you name it. And the first thing you hear about from another foreigner, specifically if you ever go to that country, is that, swipe technology is not heavy in payment. Then you realize it's probably the culture that persists, the national culture in Japan in terms of how money works, which means that they are heavy on physical money. Physical money. They're heavy on physical money. Now, this takes things to the next level. Because she explained specifically that it was a rule between the commercial banks of Japan and the central bank of Japan, the Bank of Japan, to literally reach a consensus in terms of how people, the consumers, basically interact with the money on the ground. Now, remember, I explained to you guys once that you can buy 500 yen is almost like 10 Namibian dollars. Well, let me be factual in that scenario. Because when you sometimes look at some of the particular things, I mean, okay, the yen, okay, yeah, so the yen is now currently, 9 yen for every 1 Namibian dollar. So you get 10 yen specifically out. So 500 yen would be like 50 bucks, basically, you know? So if you basically wanted to exchange money as well, it'll also be a little bit difficult in that country because in some cases, they do accept US dollar, but they've got a two-tiered pricing system, meaning if they see you're a foreigner, you pay foreign prices versus that there is actually slightly more affordable local prices if you did not know. Just giving you a heads up specifically of what the Japanese do. Now, anyway, so in terms of the naming convention and the identity of institutions, when I said the Bank of America, the actual central bank in the United States is known as the Federal Reserve. That's the actual central bank. So Bank of America is not a central bank. And just so that you know, that is a commercial bank. So early central banks were often the only or principal formal financial institution in their jurisdiction. They also literally had a direct role in terms because we also have to identify this. I mean, Namibia didn't exist 200 years ago. Namibia didn't. So these particular guys also played a sort of like a role in what they now call venture capital. They basically also played a role specifically in venture capital. Because, the word, obviously, the word bank, of a relevant city or country's name, is obviously also something that was key specifically to understand, primarily in terms of where the bank was positioned. Naming practices obviously, or subsequently also evolved as more central banks were established. The particular expression central bank itself only appeared in the early 19th century as well, but at the time it was also referred to as the head office of a multi-branched bank, meaning that the central bank technically was the head office in some cases. Now, before we continue, dear listeners, we're quickly going to take a short break, and we're going to come back right after this as we've reached the halfway point of this morning's discussion. We'll be back right after this. We'll be right back.
Make it all too clear.
Coming back there, dear listeners, from the sounds specifically of Mr. Mister. Yes, literally, that was the band's name or the group's name, Mr. Mister, with the song Broken Wings. Before that, you heard the legendary Brazilian jazz, acid jazz, funk jazz. What's that thing that Jamiroquai does a lot? I almost said synth jazz. It's the other jazz. Yeah, it's the acid jazz. From Diodato with the song Super Strut. And just where we left off specifically here on my Sunday morning take, here on your number one talk radio station of Eagle FM, was we were still on the notion in terms of looking at the basic definitions that had basically existed back then around central banks, because central banks technically are a 20th century idea. Even though they existed in the 19th century as well. But primarily they became sort of like the, you know, the set standard in since the First World War, or after the First World War, for that matter. Now, a indicator that you've also got to look into specifically has been the naming practices around central banks basically also started evolving primarily. The expression of a central bank itself only appeared in the 19th century, but at the time it also referred to the head office of a multi-branched bank, basically, and was still used in that sense by Walter Bagehot, who was a 19th century theorist of the economic role of central banks at the time. Walter Bagehot, wrote in his 1873 book Lombard Street, specifically about what the central banks would do. It was named Lombard Street, a description of the monetary market. And he basically explained the world of international corporate financing, banking, and money in understandable language. But here's the thing. There was technically only three continents at the time that were practicing banking to that extent. And technically, most of them were basically if you're an African looking at this retrospectively or in hindsight, you would go like, okay, so basically first of all, we obviously were just the extracting site. We weren't meant for further particular development and so on and so forth. And, much of the access to financing discussion was one based upon sending money from head office in Europe here to Africa. Now, during this particular issue, during the particular era of the 19th century, so everything before 1900, was that what is now known as a central bank was often referred to as a bank of issue, meaning a bank that issued. This reference to central banking, specific in the current sense, only became widespread after the First World War. So a bank of issue meant who issued the particular financial instrument. That is what the idea of central banks looked like back then, and how it was also described, meaning the bank of issue. Now, the widespread adoption of central banking is also a rather recent phenomenon, because at the start of the 20th century, approximately two-thirds of sovereign states did not have a central bank. I'll say it again. Two-thirds of sovereign states at the turn of the century, at 1900, did not have central banks. But this is also a weird phenomenon, too, because you've got to fill in the other elements in order to understand why this was the case. Well, at 1900, there was only one independent African country on the continent. That was Libya. You can basically also count the Abyssinians, who at the time consisted of the Eritreans, the Ethiopians, and the Somalis. The Abyssinians themselves were also technically, independent. And obviously, if you had to look at scenarios like that, Liberia, I don't know why I keep mixing up Liberia and Libya. Liberia is Africa's oldest independent country. I'll say it again. Liberia is Africa's oldest independent country. But Liberia obviously has its particular weaknesses. Not just for being the oldest, but also primarily in terms of it generating its own particular institutions and the likes. And if you go to Abyssinia, the same also for Abyssinia. Abyssinia doesn't exist anymore. It's now broken up into smaller countries, that being Ethiopia, Eritrea, and the two territories of Somalia. And, Djibouti is also another one. And all of this spells towards a discussion of, did these African territories have any idea of a central bank? I would say technically not. They probably would have had like a massive vault of something that contained all financing for the country, which was technically run like financing for one guy. You know, it's literally the excuse that you want to give someone to literally say, hey, listen, I'm going to make you king if I put the supervision of this particular vault under your auspice, under your particular governance. And so, sure, yes, yes, most definitely. In many cases, the central bank was probably back then treated like just like someone's personal piggy bank or someone's, you know, own slash fund, if you wanted to use a more politically charged term, slash fund. But the idea of central banks basically is a very new idea. New in terms of looking at human history and this particular thing's activity, where does it find itself? Waves of central bank adoption also occurred in the interwar period and in the aftermath of World War II. The interwar period is literally between World War I and World War II, and literally after World War II. Because then the Bretton Woods guys came about. Now, in the 20th century, central banks were often created with the intent to attract foreign capital, as bankers also preferred to lend to countries with a central bank on the gold standard. Now, the use of money as a unit of account obviously predates history in many scenarios, because government control of money is also documented in ancient Egyptian economies that ran between 2750 to 2150 BCE. The Egyptians measured the value of goods with a central unit called a shat. Like many other currencies, the shat was linked to gold. Now, that was the discussion, obviously, back in last year that Helmut and I on the home run had in terms of when Bank of Namibia came and announced that they would now start looking at collecting and building up a gold reserve. A gold reserve is not the gold standard, but a gold reserve originated from having a gold standard. So what is a gold standard? That means a gold standard is when literal gold is the basis and the existence of your economy. But you can only have so much money in your economy based on your gold reserve if you adopt the gold standard. So if you've got one carat of gold, one gold bar, you can only print money related or connected or to the value of one gold bar. I hope you guys get that. The gold reserve is not the same as gold standard. But the gold standard is based on having a gold reserve. I hope that's clear. I hope it sticks somewhere. Now, this is obviously the, in terms of the sovereignty of many countries, in terms of ensuring that, you know, various sovereign states looked after their particular own currencies, issuance of money, so on and so forth. Now, there's a reason why I mentioned a little bit earlier also that gold coins were accepted as currency. Silver coins were accepted as currency and copper coins. And then later on, it became brass coins. So they had to whittle down the value of the particular thing. But here's the here of the particular currency. When I say whittle down, I mean the lowest, let's say your 5 cent understanding. Not you personally, but your understanding around the value of a 5 cent. Let's say that 5 cent was based on being a piece of copper. And a 10 Namibian dollars, but in a coin format, would have probably been the silver coin. And then, 100 Namibian dollars would have been a gold coin. Just for example's sake. Now, as I said, paper money is something new as well. Because it only began in the 1860s. Okay, not fully. Only in the 1860s, but they were limited scenarios as well, because obviously we're talking about central banks here, and we're not talking about the when the first monies and the first paper money actually came about, because a letter of credit, what's the other word? A letter of credit, IOUs, what was the other thing's name? There was something else also. Treasury, actual treasury bonds, you know, like the actual bond. It's literally on a piece of paper. Those were things that existed as the only formats of paper, but they carried value. Now, if you guys ever seen or you've been in a class or you still remember your specific, you know, parts of your higher education where if you've ever come across commercial law and you had the discussion, you had to look at the discussion of what is acknowledged as formats of payment, and you went in checks, for example, checks specifically, checks are not actual payment, if you did not know. A check is not an actual payment. A check is a promise of a payment. It's an instruction to pay. A check is not payment. A check is only an instruction to pay. So when you've had a look, you know, into the formats of what can be deemed as money, in many cases, most countries had a gold reserve. Gold reserve was linked to the currency directly. Now, since the, as mentioned, the Egyptians measured the value of goods with a central unit that was called the shat, and this was obviously linked to their own gold reserve, the value of the shat in terms of goods was defined by government administrations. And other cultures in Asia Minor also later on materialized their countries, or their currency, sorry, into the form of gold and silver coins. Now, the mere issuance of paper currency or any other types of financial money by government is not the same as central bank banking. It's not. It is not the same. The difference is that a government-issued financial money, as present, for example, like what you would find in China during the Yuan Dynasty in the form of the paper currency, which was the one of the first instances where they discovered paper currency, is typically not freely convertible and thus of inferior quality, occasionally leading to hyperinflation. That means anyone can print it, but it doesn't mean that the thing actually carries value. Well, okay, basically to say that everyone can print it, it is also not a factual thing to say, basically, because back then they had things known as seals. A seal was literally like a stamp. Or it technically is a stamp. Now, if that currency did not have a seal on it, it didn't mean anything. Then it didn't mean anything. So they needed to obviously have seals or some mechanism that approves something to say, hey, listen, this is what this money is worth or this piece of paper is worth. From the 12th century onwards, a network of professional banks began emerging, primarily in southern Europe. So we're talking about southern France. We're talking about, for example, the Medicis in Italy. The 12th century is the earliest format probably to think about. But banks could use book money to create deposits for their customers. Thus, they had the possibility to issue, lend, and transfer money autonomously without direct control from political authorities. Now, you got something known as early municipal central banks. Now, the discussion of a municipality is also something else. For us, a municipality represents, in the modern-day scenario, in the modern-day context, and in the modern-day explanations, as a local authority, as a form of localized government from the central government of your country. This means you would never even thought about, for example, the discussion about how said particular local authority rather does achieve its particular goals throughout the various stages of humanity's history. But they did play a part because the word municipality is also technically something that we've basically inherited. Technically. When I say municipality, dear listeners, I'm literally describing to you, it was a labeling, basically. That was obviously set up in terms of how to achieve localized governance in various formats. But when you've ever tried to look for where this particular term itself, municipality, technically, you know, comes from, it has, yes, it does have a, it does have a, its roots in ancient Greek and the likes, but when you have to look at the discussion of self-governance, self-administration, and this is on a very smaller level, or it's either for another particular cut-off jurisdiction in its own root, in its own way. It has Latin roots specifically, but, and it does come from the Latin word municipium, because I, because the Romans did not have a s or an s pronunciation for their c's, so it is not municipium, it's municipium, because they didn't have an s pronunciation for their c. So it comes from the Latin phrase municipium, which means free city, but a municipality has its own government, but sometimes municipalities also join together to do something else. Now, as you've just heard, having its own particular government, which is literally the local authority scenario of things, examples like Spain, like Italy, like and the Italians have a lot of them, like the Germans start becoming the order of the day, the theme of the day discussions. For example, the Taula de Canvi de Barcelona, which was established in 1401, is the first example of a municipal, mostly public banks, which pioneered central banking on a limited scale. It was soon also emulated by the Bank of St. George, in the Republic of Genoa at the time, which was established in 1407, literally 6 years later, and also significantly later by the Banco del Giro in the Republic of Venice, and by a network of institutions in Naples that later on consolidated to become the Banco di Napoli. Now, notable municipal central banks were established in the earliest 17th century in leading northwestern European commercial centers. For example, the Bank of Amsterdam in 1609 and the Hamburger Bank in 1619. Now, these institutions also offered a public infrastructure for cashless international payments. They also aimed to increase the efficiency of international trade and to safeguard monetary stability. But these municipal public banks also fulfilled comparable functions to modern central banks. So, they did have things back then, before World War I, that looked like a central bank. But it had a dual role. It played a central bank role, but it also played a commercial role. Because they later on realized, you know what, we're in our own locality, our own jurisdiction. Our jurisdiction needs these particular financial services and assistance. So why don't we do the next, which is basically take it to the next level. So when the early national central bank idea popped up, we see that it comes to 1866 when the Swedes, through the establishment of a Swedish central bank, Sveriges Riksbank, was founded in Stockholm. Well, since 1866, it was known as Sveriges Riksbank, but it was founded in Stockholm in 1664 from the remains of the failed Stockholms Banco, And it basically answered to the Riksdag of the estates, which is literally, if you think about it, it's I almost said the Registrar of Deeds in Namibia, but it's a combination of that and the Master of the High Court, and someone else. Yeah, someone else as well. So make it, yeah, it's literally like three entities if you think about it today, because for the Swedes, it's literally the estates of, it's literally, it sounds, the, because to say the estates of Sweden, means it's literally the Registrar of Deeds. In all honesty, it's basically the Registrar of Deeds. But it has further powers, obviously. Now, the Riksdag of Estates, which is Sweden's early modern parliament, and this particular one role that the Swedish Central Bank at the time played was lending money to the government. Now, the establishment of Bank of England was devised by a gentleman by the name of Charles Montague. He, following a 1691 proposal by William Paterson. Now, this is literally also, once again, a royal decree, a royal charter. So this would be something similar to like a law that is, or an act of parliament in Namibia that is passed. So they literally said, pass this particular charter, which was granted on 27 July 1694 through the passage of the Tonnage Act. This bank was also given exclusive possession of the government's balances, and it was the only limited liability corporation that was allowed to issue bank notes, obviously, by act, by government power, by legislative power, and so on and so forth. Now, the early modern Bank of England, however, didn't have all the functions of today's central banks, because today's central banks obviously have to regulate the value of the national currency, to finance the government, and to be the sole authorized distributor of the said money, the currency, or to function as a lender of last resort to banks that are suffering a liquidity crisis. Now, in the early 18th century, a major experiment in national central banking failed in France with John Law's Banque Royale in 1720 to 1721. Why? Well, because later on, the France had other attempts also with the Caisse d'Escompte, which was first created in 1767, and Charles III, then also, that's the French king, established the Bank of Spain in 1782 as well. And the Russian Assignation Bank, which was established in 1769 by Catherine the Great, was an outlier from the general pattern of early national banks. National central banks, and it was also directly owned by the Imperial Russian government rather than a private individual shareholders. In the nascent US scenario, Alexander Hamilton, which was at that time the Secretary of Treasury in the 1790s, set up the first Bank of the United States despite heavy opposition from the Jeffersonian Republicans, as they were called. Why were they called Jeffersonians? Because they obviously followed behind Thomas Jefferson. This is the Democratic Republican Party, known as the Republican Party in the U.S. Was an American political party that was founded by Thomas Jefferson. I think he later on became president. No, it wasn't Thomas Jefferson. It was Benjamin Franklin. Yeah, but anyway, so they obviously opposed this particular idea of a central bank. But, lo and behold, the thing came to fruition. Now, we'll quickly take a short musical break, dear listeners, and we come back heading into a sort of like the last quarter of this morning's session. We'll be back right after this, and we have a listen specifically to the sounds of Rio Speedwagon with Keep On Loving You.
Should have seen by the look in my eyes.
That was right there with the sound specifically of Hall & Oates with the song Out of Time, or Out of Touch, basically. Before that, you heard the sounds of Bryan Adams with Run to You, and a little bit of, in terms of taking a look at the particular conversation that we've basically had so far in terms of central banking history and what the earliest formats basically look like. Now, just before the break, I told you specifically about elements just before 1800 that tried emulating a national central banking scenario setup, so on and so forth. Instituting, piece of legislation, obviously, to give more validity, more credibility to an institution that, obviously, at the time, that the lawmakers at the time thought needed to champion the needs for going forward. But then central banks took a twist from 1800 onwards. Central banks were also established in many European countries during the 19th century. Napoleon created the Banque de France in 1800 in order to stabilize and develop the French economy and to improve the financing of his wars. But there's a caveat right there. Let me throw in this caveat. Banking before 1800 basically existed to finance wars. Let me say it again. Banking existed to finance wars. Now, the Bank of France remained the most important continental European central bank throughout the 19th century. The Bank of Finland was founded in 1812. Soon after, Finland had been taken over from Sweden by Russia to become a Grand Duchy at the time. At the same time, a quasi-central banking role was played by a small group of powerful family-run banking networks, typified by the House of Rothschild, for example, who had branches in major cities across Europe, as well as the Hottinger family in Switzerland and the Oppenheim in Germany. The theory of the central banking, often though the name was not yet widely used, evolved in the same century of the 19th century as well. Henry Thornton, a opponent of the real bills doctrine, was a defender of the bullionist position and a significant figure in monetary theory. Now, the real bills doctrine is a doctrine, specifically a school of thought, that basically follows the particular avenue and the particular concept of saying that literally, as long as bankers lend to business people only against a security, meaning a collateral of short term, commercial papers that obviously represent claims to real goods in the process of production, the loans will be just sufficient enough to finance the production of the goods. The bullionist position has to do with gold. Now, the moment you hear of bullion, bullion speaks to gold standard because it's gold. It has to do with gold. Now, Thornton's process of monetary expansion anticipated the theories of Knut Wicksell regarding the cumulative process, which restates the aspect of quantitative theory in theoretically coherent form, as it was outlined or explained back then. But as a response to the currency crisis of 1797, Thornton then wrote in 1802 an inquiry into the nature and effects of the paper credit of Great Britain, in which he basically argued that the increase in paper credit did not cause the crisis. Okay, the Great Depression still has to happen because 1802 is a whole 100+ years away from then. But the book also gives a detailed account of the British monetary system, as well as a detailed examination of the ways in which the Bank of England should act to counteract fluctuations in the value of the pound sterling. Now, in the UK, until the mid-19th century, commercial banks were able to issue their own banknotes. Let me say it again. In the UK, commercial banks could issue their own something that resembled a currency. The notes issued by provincial banking companies were commonly in circulation. Many consider the origins of the central bank to lie with the passage of the Bank Charter Act of 1844, for example, in the UK context. Under that 1844 Act, bullionism was institutionalized in Britain. Bullionism, if you don't know, basically, like I said just a few minutes ago, has to do with the gold standard. It speaks to establishing, basing your currency's value to how much gold you've got in your bank vaults. So, this obviously meant that since the bullionism was now institutionalized in the UK, this created a ratio between the gold reserves being held by the Bank of England and the notes that the bank could issue. Now, the Act also placed strict curbs on the issuance of notes by the country banks. The Bank of England then took over a role of lender of last resort in the 1870s after a criticism of its lackluster response to the failure of Overend, Gurney and Company. Now, Overend, Gurney and Company was a London-based wholesale discount bank known as the Bankers Bank, which collapsed in 1866, owing about £11 million, which today is the equivalent of £1.1 billion. And back then, it triggered what basically became known as the first institutional or banking institution banking panic at the time. Now, a journalist also of the time, Walter Bagehot, wrote on the subject of Lombard Street, a description of the money market, in which he also advocated for the bank, this is now the Bank of England, to officially become a lender of last resort during a credit crunch, sometimes referred to as Bagehot's dictum. So the 19th century and the early 20th century's central banks in most of Europe and Japan also developed under the international gold standard. Free banking or currency boards were common at the time. Problems with collapses of banks during downturns, however, also led to a wider support for central banks in those nations which did not as yet possess a central bank. For example, Australia. In the US, the role of a central bank had been ended in the so-called Bank War of the 1830s by President Andrew Jackson. The Bank War of the 1830s, guys, was a political struggle that developed over the issue of rechartering the second bank of the US, the BUS, during the presidency of Andrew Jackson. And specifically, this resulted in a shutdown of the bank and its replacement by state banks. But before we continue, guys, we'll quickly take a short ad break and we come back right after this.
Care that goes where you go. That's international travel insurance through NHP. We facilitate cover of up to 10 million Namibian dollars per member for medical emergencies abroad as part of your membership. No extra charge. To receive your policy within minutes, simply register at nhp.com.na before you travel. T's and C's apply. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
So we come back from the quick break, and which basically signals the top of the hour at 7 a.m. And if you've just woken up, dear listeners, good morning, good morning, good morning. I do hope that you've got something hot in your palm, specifically to consume in order to fight off the chills of this, this June Sunday morning session. But just before we close up, or where we end off with this morning's discussion specifically, I highlighted specifically that in the US, the idea of a central bank basically came to an end because of the Bank War of 1830s by Andrew Jackson. And by 1913, the US then created the Federal Reserve System through the passing of the Federal Reserve Act just before the First World War. Now, following World War I, the Economic and Financial Organization of the League of Nations, influenced by the ideas of Montagu Norman. And Norman himself was an English banker, best known for his role as the governor of the Bank of England from 1920 to 1944. Very long. If you asked me, very long, superbly long. Now, the ideas from Montagu Norman and other leading policymakers and economists at the time took an active role to promote the independence of central banks, a key component of the economic orthodoxy that the EFO fostered at the Brussels Conference of 1920. Now, the EFO thus directed the creation of the Austria's National Bank, which is the Österreichische Nationalbank in Austria, the Hungarian National Bank, the Bank of Danzig, the Bank of Greece, as well as the comprehensive reforms of the Bulgarian National Bank and the Bank of Estonia. Similar ideas were also emulated in other newly independent European countries, like the National Bank of Czechoslovakia at the time. Brazil then also established a central bank in 1945, which was a precursor to the Central Bank of Brazil, which was created 20 years later. Now, after gaining independence, numerous African and Asian countries then also established central banks or monetary unions. The Reserve Bank of India, for example, which had been established during British colonial times as a private company, can you believe it, was nationalized in 1949 following India's independence. By the 21st century, most of the world's countries had a national central bank set up as a public sector institution, albeit with widely varying degrees of independence. Ours, like the description I gave you guys just a little bit earlier, ours is an act. So it is publicly owned. It's the South African one that you've got to be worried about, because the South African one is technically not owned by the government itself. But then I heard just now recently that in South Africa you can establish a company or an organization for public good, obviously under South African laws, that can be empowered by an act. You can establish a company for good that can be empowered by an act. Let me say it again. You can establish a company, you can register something for public good, and it can be empowered by an act. A government act. So, just rounding out this last particular leg, central banks in the developing world were also formerly basically extensions of financing from colonial powers into the colonial territories. Before the near generalized adoption of the model of a national public sector central bank, a number of economies actually relied on a central bank that was effectively or legally run from outside of their country. That's the thing that many Africans, or basically many Namibians, did not understand of what was happening between France and the Francophone-speaking African countries. The first colonial central banks, such as the Bank of Java in Indonesia, which was established in 1828 in Batavia. Batavia was the old name of the Netherlands. The Bank d'Algérie, which was established in 1851 in Algiers. Or the Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, which was established in 1865 in Hong Kong. Now, that name that I just read out, the Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, is another name, or is the full name, of the currently acting British commercial bank, HSBC. That is HSBC's full name. Now, these guys operated from the colony itself. Following the generalization of the transcontinental use of the electrical telegraph, using submarine telecommunications cables, However, new colonial banks were typically headquartered in the colonial metropolis. Prominent examples include the Paris-based Banque d'Indochine, which was established in 1875, the Banque de l'Afrique Occidentale, which was established in 1901, and the Banque de Madagascar in 1925. The Banque d'Algérie's head office was relocated from Algiers to Paris in 1900. In some cases, independent countries which did not have a strong domestic base of capital accumulation, that's basically just to say you didn't have any means of, you know, collecting money in your economy. Wow. And were critically reliant on foreign funding, found advantage in granting essential banking role to banks that were effectively or even legally foreign. A particular case was the Imperial Ottoman Bank, which was established in 1863 as a French-British joint venture. And a particularly egregious one was the Paris-based National Bank of Haiti, which was established in 1881, which captured significant financial resources from the economically struggling, rather independent nation of Haiti. In other cases, which included the London-based Imperial Bank of Persia, Iran, which was established in 1885, and the Rome-based National Bank of Albania, which was established in 1925. The State Bank of Morocco was established in 1907 with international shareholding and headquarters functions distributed between France and Tangier. And literally 5 years later, before the country lost its independence. And in other cases, there have been organized currency unions, such as the Belgium-Luxembourg Economic Union, which was established in 1921, under which Luxembourg had no central bank, but that was managed by a national central bank, in the case of the National Bank of Belgium, rather than a supranational bank. Present-day common monetary area of Southern Africa has a comparable features as well. And another pattern was set in countries where federated or otherwise sub-foreign entities had wide policy autonomy that was also echoed to varying degrees in the organization of the central bank itself. These included, for example, the Austro-Hungarian Bank of 1878 to 1918, the U.S. Federal Reserve in its first two decades, the Bank Deutscher Länder between 1948 and 1957, or the National Bank of Yugoslavia between 1972 and 1993. Conversely, some of these countries that are also politically organized as federations, such as Canada, the Canada of today, Mexico of today, and Switzerland of today, rely on a unitary central bank. And on that note, dear listeners, it does bring us up to the end for this morning session of my Sunday morning take, primarily. We will get back by saying our goodbyes, firstly, and quickly taking a short break and coming back right after that, before we cross over to the next program.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tite opoye ekukurile oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana unongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo IGL FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda beri nawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa ninge kwa tafanona monika ko IGL FM onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile kumberewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafilane IGL FM the eye.
Well, it's at that time, dear listeners, that we've got to say our goodbyes. We've got to wish you a good morning. And specifically, if you've just woken up, I do hope that you've got something hot in your hands. And on that particular notion, dear listeners, it does bring us up to the end of this morning session of my Sunday Morning Take. On that note, we say our goodbyes and we'll see each other again.